The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'm going to be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and possibly from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter as well. The first article comes from the Harvard Heart Letter, and it's entitled Ask the Doctor by Dr. Deepak L. Bhatt, M.D. And the first question concerns yoga and high blood pressure. Question: I have coronary artery disease and take medications for high blood pressure. I did yoga when I was younger and would like to resume the practice. Are there any poses I should avoid? Answer: Restarting your yoga practice is a terrific idea. Yoga may help to lower your blood pressure, especially if you practice often. A 2019 review and analysis of earlier data published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings found that people, most of whom were overweight, middle-aged adults with high blood pressure, who did yoga for an hour, five times a week for 13 weeks, had a significant reduction in their blood pressure. The improvements were even greater when the yoga practice included breathing techniques and meditation. While you're doing yoga, as is true for any type of exercise, your blood pressure will naturally rise, especially if you move quickly or hold poses for a longer period of time. Play it safe by restarting with a beginner or gentle yoga class. To minimize possible spikes in blood pressure, move slowly from one pose to the next. If the teacher has you hold a pose longer than 10 seconds, you may want to take a break by moving briefly out of the pose and then back into it. If you feel the need, rest between moves in child's pose, which means kneeling with your knees apart, belly resting between your thighs, resting your forehead on the ground. Holding your breath may also elevate blood pressure, so keep breathing. Something a good instructor is going to remind you about periodically during class anyway. Extending the length of your inhalations and exhalations can help to calm your nervous system. But take care not to strain or force your chest or abdomen to expand as you inhale. As for poses to avoid, most people, not just those with heart disease, should be cautious about inversions. These poses, which place the heart higher than the head, require the heart to pump against gravity and tend to be more challenging. Some of the more advanced inversions, like the shoulder stand, headstand, and handstand, are not a good idea. One common inversion, which is called downward facing dog, is generally fine for people with well-controlled high blood pressure, says Dr. Darshan Mehta, assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and medical editor of the Harvard Special Health Report Intermediate Yoga. But it's always best to check with your doctor if you have concerns about specific poses. Finally, always end your practice with meditation, which is sometimes done while lying on your back, in a pose called Savasana. This ritual helps relax your body as your breathing rate and blood pressure gradually drop. Now we're going to read an article also from the Harvard Heart Letter. This is the May 2022 issue, and it's entitled Tips for Choosing Walking Shoes. Brisk walking is one of the simplest and best exercises you can do to protect your heart, so put your best foot forward. A low-impact exercise that you can do almost anywhere, walking is practical and popular. Another oft-mentioned perk of walking, the only gear you really need is a comfortable pair of shoes. But if you're doing your daily walks in sneakers that are comfy but well-worn, it might be time to invest in a new pair of dedicated walking shoes. You should probably replace your walking shoes every 300 to 500 miles. If you walk briskly for 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, that means a new pair every 6 to 12 months. Plus, brand new, well-fitting walking shoes just might put a little more spring in your step and encourage you to walk a bit farther. The right shoes will help you to avoid common foot and ankle injuries like plantar fasciitis, which is the inflammation of the fibrous band of tissue in the bottom of the foot, and Achilles tendonitis, which is inflammation of the tendon connecting the calf muscle to the head, to the heel, rather. But if you have any type of existing foot pain or impairment that makes walking uncomfortable, don't rely on a shoe to fix your problem, says Dr. Adam Tenford, director of the Running Medicine Program at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehab Hospital. Instead, consult a podiatrist or physical therapist to properly address the problem, he advises. Feet come in varied shapes and sizes, so it's impossible to recommend a specific walking shoe brand or style that would suit everyone. Comfort is the most important factor, and a shoe should feel good as soon as you slip it on. But don't assume that the more support and cushioning a walking shoe has, the better. Some research suggests that thinner, more flexible soles put less stress on the knees, probably because they allow your foot to move in a more natural fashion. At this point, there is a picture, and it is entitled Shoe Selection Suggestions. And the author of the article suggests cushioning. A soft inner sole relieves pressure on the foot. Space. You should not crowd the toes. Give them plenty of room with a wide toe box. Length. Your shoe should be half an inch beyond your longest toe. Material. Look for uppers with some stretch. Fabric uppers are preferred. And stability. A sturdy area around your heel keeps your foot from slipping. For the best selection plus expert advice, you're better off going to a specialty running store instead of a large chain retailer. You can even wear a running shoe for walking because both are designed for forward motion. Sometimes employees offer to analyze your feet or your old shoes to see if your foot tends to lean inward, pronation, or outward, supination as you walk. But Dr. Tenford isn't convinced this practice is necessary. Research suggests that for healthy people, matching shoe type to address pronation or supination doesn't prevent more injuries than wearing a neutral shoe. Here's a few other things. You should always shop late in the day. Because your feet tend to expand by the end of the day, it's best to try on new shoes when your feet are at their largest. You should choose your socks first. The thickness of your socks affects how your shoes fit. Find some you like and take them to the shoe store. Avoid 100% cotton socks, which stay damp if they get wet, setting you up for a blister. Synthetic or cotton synthetic blends will wick away moisture. Give the shoe a bend. Grab the toe and heel of the shoe and pull them toward each other. The shoe should bend easily at the ball of the foot. If it doesn't, look for another style that does. The flexibility offers a greater range of motion and an easier push-off. Look for a low heel. Stay away from shoes with big, bulky heels, which can hinder the natural rolling foot motion of the walking and may make you more prone to tripping. Allow one finger's width between your longest toe and the front of your shoe, as your feet may swell more in warm weather and on longer walks. And it's always a good idea to take a test walk. To get a feel for the shoe, take a few laps around the store. Try on a few different brands with one on each foot for side-by-side comparison. If you notice any rubbing, discomfort, or sore spots, try a different pair. The next article, also from the Harvard Heart Letter, is what causes a stiff, narrowed aortic valve? About 5% of people age 65 and older have aortic stenosis, but symptoms usually don't appear until the condition becomes severe. The term stenosis, from a Greek word meaning to narrow, refers to the narrowing of a passage or opening in the body. Stenosis of the aortic valve, which regulates the flow of blood from the heart to the rest of the body, can be serious. Left untreated, severe aortic stenosis can lead to heart failure and sudden death. The incidence increases with age, rising from just over 1% for people in their 60s to 10% for those 80 and older. But exactly what causes an aortic valve to narrow? And is there any way to prevent the problem from developing or progressing? In the United States, the most common cause is a buildup of scar tissue and calcium deposits, known as fibrocalcific aortic valve disease, says Dr. Yi-Ping Sun, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Calcium, the most abundant mineral in the body, is stored mostly in your bones and your teeth. But calcium is transported in the blood, and it can accumulate in both valves and the arteries of the heart. Calcium deposits in the heart don't appear to be connected to the amount of calcium you consume from either foods or supplements, says Dr. Sun. Contributing factors. In addition to age, a range of other factors can affect if and when a person develops aortic stenosis. One is a condition present at birth that is often not discovered until the person reaches middle age. It is called bicuspid aortic valve. Another less frequent cause is rheumatic heart disease, a complication of untreated strep throat infection that over time damages a person's heart valves. Today, rheumatic heart disease is rare in the United States, although it still occurs in some people, like older adults who had strep throat during childhood, before antibiotics were available or commonly accessible. Certain health problems may increase a person's odds of aortic stenosis, including kidney disease, hyperparathyroidism, and inflammatory disorders like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and systemic sclerosis. Having radiation therapy to the chest, usually done to treat lymphoma, is another risk factor. Elevated blood levels of fatty particle called lipoprotein A, or LPA, also appear to contribute to aortic stenosis. LPA particles are like the better known LDL cholesterol particles, but with an extra protein attached. Doctors don't routinely measure LPA when evaluating people for aortic stenosis, but that may change with advancement in our understanding of LPA and ways to treat it, says Dr. Sun. Aortic stenosis can cause shortness of breath, fatigue, and lightheadedness, especially when you're physically active. But these common symptoms have many causes, so they're not very helpful for pinpointing the problem. Fainting, as well as chest tightness or discomfort, can also occur. Sometimes aortic stenosis is discovered when a doctor hears an abnormal heart sound through the stethoscope. The blood flow through the narrowed valve is turbulent, creating a sound that's initially loud and then quieter, known as a crescendo-decrescendo murmur. But increasingly, aortic stenosis is found during an ultrasound of the heart done for another reason, says Dr. Sun. And of course, an ultrasound of the heart is also called an echocardiogram. Unfortunately, there are no strategies to prevent the progression of aortic stenosis. If an echocardiogram reveals only mild stenosis, your doctor will probably recommend a repeat echocardiogram every 3 to 5 years. Moderate stenosis should be checked every year. If you start having symptoms from severe aortic stenosis, it's time for a new aortic valve. For many people, including those with bicuspid valves, surgery is the best option. But a less invasive non-surgical approach called transcatheter aortic valve implantation is an option for an increasing number of patients. Now, once again from the Harvard Heart Letter, is an interesting article entitled "Hospitalization After a Mini Stroke? Not Necessarily. For Preventing a Future Stroke, Special Clinics that Test for the Underlying Causes of Stroke Seem to Be Just as Effective." A temporary disruption in blood flow to part of your brain, often called a mini stroke, can alter how you move, speak, or see. Also known as a transient ischemic attack, or TIA, this unsettling event may last just a few minutes or many hours. Once the symptoms subside, you may feel perfectly normal and be tempted to forget it ever happened. But 1 in 6 people who experience a TIA has a full-blown stroke in the next 3 months, and this can have devastating effects. Anti-clotting medications are usually started right away in people with suspected TIA or stroke, but they should also undergo testing as soon as possible to uncover the underlying cause. While there is no consensus on how and where such testing should occur, TIA patients have traditionally received it during a brief hospital stay after being seen in the emergency department. But new research suggests that people who are evaluated at specialized outpatient clinics fare just as well as those who are hospitalized. It's encouraging to know that we're on the right track in developing these TIA clinics, says Dr. Christopher Anderson, chief of the Division of Stroke and Cerebrovascular Disease at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. If you arrive in the emergency room at midnight and receive a TIA diagnosis and a reassuring preliminary workup, doctors at facilities with access to a TIA clinic can schedule all the necessary follow-up tests to be done in the next 3 days. Stroke risk is highest within the first week after a TIA. The specific tests people receive at a TIA clinic depends on their medical history, but they usually include a heart ultrasound or echocardiogram to check for blood clots or heart abnormalities, cardiac monitoring to check for atrial fibrillation, and imaging testing of arteries in the brain and neck. The results guide targeted stroke prevention treatments, which can reduce the risk of future stroke by as much as 80%. Initially, doctors were worried they might be missing problems that could occur soon after a TIA that would be picked up more effectively in a hospital, says Dr. Anderson. But it's now clear that many people are fine to go home after the emergency visit and receive these tests promptly as an outpatient. TIA clinics are more convenient and less costly for patients, and hospitals can keep their beds available for people who are more seriously ill. However, People with health problems that put them at high risk for a stroke are still admitted to the hospital after a TIA. To help predict this risk, doctors use the A, B, C, D, 2 score, among other criteria. At present, many community hospitals don't yet have access to TIA clinics, so they end up admitting TIA patients to the hospital to make sure speedy workup doesn't fall through the cracks. But increasingly, these smaller hospitals are partnering with large academic centers with TIA clinics, which should expand access to more people in the future, says Dr. Anderson. Then there's a little section that explains what is meant by an ABCD2 score. Doctors use the ABCD2 score to assess a person's risk of having a stroke. People with a high point total, usually 4 and above, may need to be hospitalized after a TIA rather than being sent to a TIA clinic. And these risk factors are age 60 or older, which is worth 1 point, blood pressure, a systolic blood pressure above 140, or a diastolic pressure over 90, which is worth 1 point, clinical features that include trouble with speech but no weakness, which is worth 1 point, and weakness on one side of the body, which is worth 2 points, and duration. If the symptoms last 10 to 59 minutes is worth 1 point, and 60 minutes or more is worth 2 points. Having diabetes is also worth 1 point. Now here's another article from the Harvard Heart Letter of May 2022, which is entitled Understanding Secondary Hypertension. Sometimes high blood pressure results from an underlying condition. Should you be checked for these problems? High blood pressure usually results from age, genetics, obesity, a high salt diet, or lack of exercise. But up to 10% of people with high blood pressure have secondary hypertension, which is a byproduct of another condition or disease. Most of the time, secondary hypertension is caused by problems with the adrenal glands or the arteries supplying the kidneys. Diagnosis and treatment of the underlying condition often improves or even resolves the elevated blood pressure. There are 4 main groups of people in whom you might suspect secondary hypertension, says Dr. Randall Zussman, who is the director of the Division of Hypertension at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. And those 4 groups are people who develop high blood pressure before age 30, people who have never had high blood pressure but then develop it out of the blue after age 70, people who experience a sudden rise in blood pressure following many years of stable hypertension, and people who have blood pressure above 130 over 80 despite taking 4 or more medications. The most common cause of secondary hypertension is hyperaldosteronism, in which one or both adrenal glands make too much aldosterone. This hormone raises blood pressure by telling the kidneys to hold on to sodium and water and sending it back to the bloodstream, boosting the blood volume. A common cause is a benign growth of one of the adrenal glands. Another common cause is bilateral adrenal hyperplasia. Hyperaldosteronism is uncommon in young people and more likely in those who are middle-aged with poorly controlled blood pressure. A low potassium level can be a red flag. Another important cause of secondary hypertension is narrowed kidney arteries. Renal artery stenosis, a narrowing of the arteries that supply the kidneys with blood, is another common cause of secondary hypertension. This condition typically stems from a buildup of fatty plaque in artery walls a problem usually seen in older people. But it can also occur in young women with an inherited condition called fibromuscular dysplasia, which is marked by an overgrowth of muscular tissue in artery walls. Doctors are more likely to suspect renal artery stenosis among people in groups 1, 3, and 4. In other words, people who develop high blood pressure at a young age, or have a sudden rise in blood pressure, or have high blood pressure in spite of taking multiple medications. Another possible cause of secondary hypertension is Cushing's syndrome, which is due to the overproduction of cortisol by the adrenal glands or from long-term use of steroid drugs. Also, thyroid disorders and sleep apnea, a disorder in which you stop breathing for short periods during sleep, can also trigger rises in hormones that raise blood pressure. Secondary hypertension is also common among people with so-called resistant hypertension, which includes people in the fourth group. In other words, those whose blood pressure is still elevated despite taking 4 medications. 1 in 4 people with resistant hypertension end up having an identifiable secondary cause. However, the most likely explanation for stubborn high blood pressure is lifestyle habits. People just aren't taking their medication as prescribed, or they're consuming too much sodium. Some are taking other medications or dietary supplements that elevate the blood pressure. When these habits aren't to blame, doctors will look for clues to other secondary causes, which can be revealed by a physical exam and specialized blood or imaging testing. Remember, high blood pressure has no symptoms, and secondary causes can strike anyone. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. NCREADING. SERVICE.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.